It's March 30th, 2017, Masoret. So yesterday we discussed the idea that the Sipur deals with the story, the events, and the miracles. Especially the miracles are extremely important to recount. That seems to be the essential feature, as the Rambam says, to talk about the Nisim and the Niflos. And the Ramban expands upon that. I don't know if I'll go into it right now, as to what's so unique and special about the miracles that took place in Mitzrayim. That part of the Sipur also involves discussions about the halacha. And in fact, in the answer to the Ben Chacham, to the wise son, it mentions that you should teach him kehilchos ha-pesach. That doesn't mean, of course, that you just confine the discussion to halacha. Because that's where the Rambam actually brings down. The Rambam mentions the different levels of the discussion of the Higadat HaLevincha. There's a separate mitzvah incorporated into Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, is a, I guess you'd call it a branch of the mitzvah, an aspect of the mitzvah, which is to teach one's children. So even though it's a general mitzvah, the mitzvah devolves upon the father, since he has the obligation of studying Torah. And whoever is obligated to study Torah has an obligation to teach Torah. And the teaching, primarily, there's different when it comes to teaching, who are you obligated to teach? So it's interesting that there's a general obligation and then there's a particular, a specific obligation. In terms of the specific obligation, there's an intrinsic requirement to teach your children a Torah. Again, there too, primarily the son. I mean, of course, in reality, you're going to teach your daughter and your daughter has to keep... I'm just talking though in a purely abstract sense. Because again, in the purely abstract sense, there's a system that God established. So there's two things. There's personal obligations, and your obligations to your children. You know, you're not going to say, I have an obligation to see to it that my son keeps the Torah, but not my daughter. You know, that would be absurd. But in terms of the abstract system, the abstract nature of the mitzvah, so it seems to me that the mitzvah of teaching Torah is part of the plan of Hashem. That is, it's part of the goal, that is that the Torah should be preserved. And the only way that the Torah is preserved and perpetuated is through transmission. And transmission, first and foremost, has to do with those who are responsible to keep it. It's sort of like a self-sufficient kind of a phenomenon. So, therefore, a person, the man, has an intrinsic obligation to teach his son. But he has an obligation to teach others as well. That is, basically, whoever comes to you, whoever comes to him for Torah, he has an obligation to teach. But that's a different kind of thing. Because there's, you know, various conditions attached to that. That presumes that you have the time, you have the opportunity, and so forth. But with regard to the son, it's intrinsic. You have a chiyuv. So you have to teach him and see to it. If you can't do all the teaching, which is the way we do it now, so you send the child to a yeshiva. Now, in terms of Pesach, the night of Pesach, that's the night of teaching, essentially, because you see, it's incorporated into the Haggadah. It's not just a tangential thing that you include children in the Seder. But it's part of the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. to teach it to the children. That's the night of teaching, the night of transmitting the Masorah that's been designated. And that's for Yigdal Telavincha. Now, with, of course, the thing that you're going to be talking about is Yitzias Mitzrayim, because of the significance of the Yitzias Mitzrayim. Because Yitzias Mitzrayim is fundamentally the foundation. That's the foundation of the acceptance of God, that we accepted Hashem as our God. And that's something that we affirm twice a day in the Shema. So this comes into play, this idea comes into play early on. In the opening paragraphs of the Haggadah, if you have a Haggadah in front of you. Okay, so it begins with Kiddush, because essentially, which is very, very interesting, it was decided that the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, to tell the story of the Exodus, was incorporated actually into the meal. It's part of the meal. And if you'll tell me, but the meal hasn't started yet, and the meal starts after you've concluded the Sipur, it's not true, really, because the meal begins with Kiddush. So that's the purpose, that's the function of Kiddush in general, is to be koveya, to establish and to designate the Suda as a Suda of Shabbos, or it's a Suda of Yom Tov. And here, it's beginning. It's the beginning and the establishment of the Seder. And in fact, the Kiddush itself contains a reference to Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus, and that's why it's considered one of the four cups. It's the first of the four cups. So essentially, from that point, the meal is beginning. The meal begins with Kiddush. And even though we wash later, and even though Ein Kiddush El B'Makom Suda, that there's a principle that Kiddush must be at the place of the Suda, which practically speaking means that you should go from Kiddush to Suda. As soon as you finish making Kiddush, again on Friday night or Yontif, or any time, you're supposed to wash. So you connect the Suda to the Kiddush. It would be wrong to then stop and then engage in some other activity or to leave or whatever. Then you're not even going to be Yotzei the Kiddush, because the Kiddush was not connected to the Suda. So you're supposed to make it immediately. Yet here we don't do that. We don't wash. We proceed with many, many things are done. It could take a while. It could take a couple of hours, depending on how slow or fast you are. But I would say, I can't say for most people, because there are people that go through the Haggadah very quickly. And it could be a half hour, 45 minutes. But I think most people that try to have a real, some semblance of a Seder with discussion and ideas, it's going to take at least an hour. And often it takes longer. So what do you do with the issue of Kiddush B'Makom Suda? Again, that there can't be an interruption between the Kiddush and the Suda. Okay, so I would say basically that this does not constitute an interruption, because it's a very unique kind of a meal. It's a meal that the meal itself, everything you're doing on that night has the purpose and the function of Sipur, Yetzias Mitzrayim. So it's kind of a celebration of the Exodus. Okay, so thus, if that's the theme, so the Haggadah would not constitute a hefset, an interruption. Now, all right, so then you have the Karpas. Okay. So the preliminary elements in the Haggadah after Kiddush is the Karpas, which is done to stimulate a question, as we know. And then you have what follows after that is the questions. You know, how is this night different, and so on and so forth. And after that, you have a few paragraphs, sort of by way of introduction to the Sipur. And they're basically establishing halachic points. For example, Avadam Hayinu. We were slaves to Paro in Egypt. It's not really telling the story, just mentioning very briefly. But the real purpose of that is to establish the foundation for the mitzvah. Because we were slaves to Paro in Egypt, and God took us out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. And had God not taken us out, then we and our children and children's children would be slaves to Paro in Egypt. That's an important point. Why do we have to say that, or why do we have to be cognizant of that? Because that is expressing the basis of the obligation. It's interesting how precise everything is in the Haggadah. In other words, why do I have to tell the story? Why do I have to tell this story? And then why do I have to give praise to Hashem for the Exodus? That's what this paragraph is taking up. Not to say, that we're not grateful for things that happen to other people. But when it comes to a mitzvah of this nature, it's got to be something personal. That's a very important theme. It's probably one of the most difficult themes that we find in the Haggadah. And that is that a person is telling the story and performing the mitzvos as though all of these things happened to him. And that becomes a full-fledged obligation that a person is obligated to view things, to view it as though he himself was a slave in Egypt and was removed. That's not an easy thing to do, but that's a mitzvah. The Rambam quotes the sources for it, that a person has to look at it that way. Anyways, that means it's a personal obligation. The obligation then to tell the story is not because Hashem did something for your forefathers, which wouldn't be, that wouldn't be unreasonable, but it goes beyond that. And that is that God did something for you. If a person has that realization, then the night becomes easier. As I said, because for many people, it's a funny kind of thing to say to her. It exerts a tremendous attraction. It is kind of strange. It's one of the most, if not the most, popular item on the Jewish calendar. And everybody will attend the Seder of some kind, it seems to me. It's so popular, even Gentiles, either they have a Seder or they get invited by their Jewish friends to a Seder. I'm not going into there are halachic issues with that, with having a Gentile as a guest. Essentially, the problem being that on Yantif, you're not allowed to invite the Gentiles to meals, to the holiday meals. You are allowed to invite them on Shabbos. The reason being that there is a fear that you might cook extra for the Gentile, and you're not allowed to. You're allowed to cook on Yantif, but the cooking is for the sake of enjoying the Yantif. So that's why cooking is permitted. So that's only for someone who's observing the Yantif, but a guy is not obligated in the Yantif. So therefore you're not allowed to cook for a guy on Yantif. So therefore, I know you could say, well, okay, I'm not going to cook for him, I'm going to prepare the food in advance. However, the decree, the Gezerah, was made lest you, because it happens that, you invite people, then you realize you don't have enough food. So just to make sure, you'll cook something on Yantif itself. Now that's fine, you're allowed to do that. But that would be presupposed that all the people are Jews. and therefore they're all included in the category of rejoicing on the Yontif. However, since you're not allowed to cook for a guy, and that would be a biblical violation to do so, so because of that, they said you should not, you cannot, the Midrabanan, you're not allowed to invite a guy to the meal. It's a very interesting thing, because it doesn't mean, that is, if he comes of his own accord to visit you without having, let's say, you know, you're really good friends, and he just felt that he could come and participate without being invited, then you don't turn him away. Because that's not the obligation. That's not the gzeirah. The gzeirah was not to invite. But if he's there for other reasons and you didn't invite him, so it's all right. Anyways, I was saying that it's a strange thing, because it's the most sought after or the most popular event, and yet once it begins, people get edgy. I would say that it's the ones who tend to get edgy, and you know, they sort of let's hurry it up. When are we going to eat? It's not so much the less religious, that is, the ones that are not that religious, and they're sort of, but a Seder is an important thing, and they're excited. They sort of want to learn. They come with a better attitude. People that have been religious for years and years, but they're not really on an intellectual level. They go through the motions, so to speak, but they're religious. They keep all of the holidays and so forth. So that, you know, it's not a big deal to them. They just want to get through it. Anyways, this paragraph establishes that it's a mitzvah upon us, because we too were redeemed. And since we were redeemed, we have to give praise to Hashem. And we have to therefore engage in Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. And then, of course, it goes on to say that even if we're all wise, and it's not just an, you know, we know the Torah, that is, the greatest sage is obligated to involve himself in this. Because even though you might say, well, he knows it all, he knows the story, it's not necessarily because of that purpose, but it's to be involved in the experience. There's two things, obviously, in a story. One is the knowledge. I want to know what happened. And once I know what happened, there's no need to go over it. But then there's an emotional affect that the story produces. That, you see, people will tell their really significant stories of their past. A person will tell it over many times in his life, because it brings back a certain type of a feeling. It's a cherished story. So I would say that each person has cherished stories. How I first met you, or how this, or how that, or a person, you know, something unusual happened in his life, and whatever the case may be. So I would say he puts that in a separate compartment. There's stories. They may have been of interest, and you told them, and that's it. You don't want to tell it over again. It's boring, and we all know the fact. Okay. But I think that most people have cherished stories. Now, that doesn't mean there's a reality to everything. You can't tell it over too frequently. But on a certain, you know, with a certain type of a regularity or a duration, in other words, of a certain, every so often, sometimes every year or every other year, you know, you see, when the right moment comes, you sort of like indulge, you'll retell the story. So that's the thing over here. It's not an informational phenomenon, but it's an experiential phenomenon. Okay, having said that, it then proceeds, and you have, because what the methodology of the Haggadah, there's a methodology here, just like we mentioned yesterday, that in general, the method is to make a statement and back it up with a pasuk. Okay? Now, there's another method that's used as well. And it's, see, all this is extremely instructive, which can be carried over to other areas of life. The other method that's employed is to teach an idea, to establish a principle, and to follow it up with an illustration. Now, to me, that's very, very important in general teaching. Because especially as the idea becomes a little complex, it's not exactly clear what you're saying. So if you have a good example, a good illustration, and you combine it with the principle, that's very good. That's good teaching. So that's what we see in the Haggadah. And I would say, I mean, look, it's with everybody, but especially children, because maybe they can't conceptualize that well. But once you tell them a story, I found it with adults too. I found it as a rabbi on the shul level many, many times that people love a story. I mean, I can't just use all, you know, the commonplace stories that are purely emotional and they even convey false ideas, you know. So I have to be very careful. But when I do find a good story and it illustrates a point I'm trying to make, so that becomes much more successful. People like that. They like a good story. Now again, if you give the idea, and it's just the idea, and it's just the conceptual and the explanation, it could be very good, but as like I'm saying, it lacks something on the emotional level. People want to see concrete. I guess to a certain extent it has to do with the level of people in terms of their perception of truth. That people that are extremely, you know, abstract and logical, so the idea is real for them. They don't need anything more. But for many people, all right, it's a good idea, but did it ever happen? You know, they need the fact that it actually occurred, that it actually happened. That seals it for them. Then it becomes real. It doesn't become real if it's just on the level of the abstract. You could just show something by logic. It has to be this way. Okay, it's not going to... But if you could then follow it up with a case that illustrates it, that same logic, and it happened that way, then obviously it's going to be more effective. Okay, so then it follows up with that maisa that we discussed yesterday of Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Tarfon, who are reclining in Bnei Brak, and they were mesaprim. They were discussing Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim throughout the entire night until their students came and interrupted them, telling them that the time for Kriya Shema had come. Now, it's interesting the nature of this story, because the story doesn't just illustrate the point. It goes way beyond that. You didn't need this much. It's telling you about these are the greatest scholars of the time, probably all of all time. I mean, they're among the greatest teachers and scholars of all time, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, and so forth, and that they got together for the sake of the Seder, and that the fact that they were talking all night, which is past the Zman, essentially, because the time for the eating of the karban, you know, which the sipur is attached to, is chatzos, is basically midnight. And then you have the phenomenon of the students. So the story they give, of course it illustrates the point, but it goes way, way, way beyond that. And that's the components, that these are the greatest talmidei chachamim, and they certainly knew everything pertaining to Yetzias Mitzrayim, but nevertheless, they gathered together, Now the gathering together. All of this you see is for the purpose of the increase. You see the tremendous potential. Here I would say it's not just the experiential factor of the cherished story, but it shows you the intellectual potential. It shows you the intellectual potential. That is, it is a story which opens up. Once you open it up, and that's just what Torah is, because there's so many, maybe the surface story is kind of limited, because how much, you got the basic story, you're not going to go into every little, of course, if you went in any story, you went to the grocery today and bought a few things, you can make that, you could talk about that for weeks, if you're going to break down every little detail. Of course, there's like an infinite amount of details. But that would be ridiculous because it's, it would be a waste of time. You're just going to tell the essentials, which is, if we're dealing with the essentials of a story, that's how much do you need to know? The police take a report of a crime. It's not infinite. It's finite. But what this particular paragraph is opening up to us is the fact that on the intellectual level, it's endless. Because the components over here are of the kind that if you plumb into it, there's tremendous depths. And I would say that that applies to the two aspects of the story. Certainly, if you start to go into the halachic elements, then you understand. You have these great Torah scholars, and they're plumbing the depths. And if they get involved in just a few of the halachos, this tremendous wisdom and areas to inquire into. And even in the other aspect, when they take up the other aspects of the shibud of Egypt and so on and so forth, if you take it to a deeper level, it involves very significant points in Torah. There's so many points about the suffering of the Jews and why they had to suffer, and then God's hashkacha, God's providence, and so on and so forth. If you go through all of that, then that too is an endless body of knowledge. So that's what the story is really illustrating. And it also shows the ability of Torah to captivate a person. These are people that were completely captivated. To the extent, it didn't even matter, to the extent that they forgot about what they had to do in terms of mitzvahs even. It's also showing the sublime nature that the study of Torah occupies. Because when it says, or basically is telling you that they needed to be reminded about Kriya Shema, it's not saying so in a critical way, to criticize them. That is, that they were lax in the mitzvah of Kriya Shema. You don't get that sense at all. To the contrary, that's a compliment. That even something which was really important to them, the mitzvah, and not just any mitzvah, the mitzvah of Kriya Shema, it didn't matter. Because they were totally captivated by a Torah discussion. So that's the point that's being made over here. We get a glimpse. Now, we're not on that level, I don't think. We get a glimpse of the real nature of Torah study. That it has the potential to captivate you. And again, the Torah presents an ideal, and it's not all or nothing. It's not either you're like these rabbis, and it's all night long, and you forget about Kriya Shema, or nothing. It's not true. There's different degrees. Each person has to incorporate that idea into his own life, and the extent to which you cultivate that capability, then to that extent you're elevating yourself. That is to say, it's a good thing to be captivated by Torah. Okay, so that point has been made. Now, we go on to the next paragraph, which is interesting. And there's a lot of commentary here. This seems to be taking up a halachic discussion. I'm Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, Harei ani kaven shivim shana. I am as, everybody comments on that. That I'm as one. I'm like someone who's 70 years old. And some want to say because he really was young, but he was appointed to be the head of the Sanhedrin. And sort of miraculously, his appearance changed and he appeared to be older. I guess the point being because that's a significant factor. It shows you, I mean, according to that interpretation, that appearance does count, even in the world of Torah. Where in reality, it doesn't. It doesn't, but in certain positions, and certainly, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind, I've seen this, that people are very affected by a person's appearance. And, you know, due to certain things, they've become accustomed. They, you know, like the rabbi should have a certain look. He's got to have a, generally that includes a beard. And not just that he dresses, but he has to dress like almost like a uniform type of a suit, the certain type of a white shirt, generally. Even if he has a suit and a tie, but if it's a colored shirt, it's more fashionable, whatever the case may be. But that look, so that's very, very important. Because that's the way they've been programmed to respond. So if you have two rabbis, one does not have that look, even if he's dressed appropriately, but he doesn't have that look, doesn't have that beard, and so on and so forth. And you have the other one, and the one without the look, if you listen to what he's saying, that his ideas and his presentation is much, much more convincing and educational, whatever the case may be. But in general, all things being equal, do you see that the audience will be geared towards what the other one says? Because he's the authority, and he lays it down, and that's just the way it is. That's a, so I would say over here too, that he needed to have that look. And that's what, so Hashem conveyed it upon him, that look. But anyways, the story is really illustrating a different idea, and that is that he says, V'lo zochisi. I don't think the plain meaning is that, though, that you have to learn that way. Because the word kiven, it's just an implication. And the truth of the matter is, in terms of the intent of the paragraph, it makes more sense to say he was 70, actually 70. Because it's trying to tell you, what it's trying to tell you is that even at the age of 70, he learned something new. That's what it's conveying. He learned something which he did not know before. Now, if you're going to learn that he really was young, except his appearance changed, and he looked like someone who was 70, so then that takes away from the point. So then it's not such a glaring point that he didn't know such a fundamental thing. But if you're saying that he actually was 70, so then that's the point. You'd assume that a great scholar at the age of 70 would know these kinds of things, and it's trying to tell you that it's not the case. That fits in with what we've said, that Torah is an endless kind of a study, and that one, it's very, very possible that even a great rabbi will not know something which appears, something can appear to be a simple fundamental point, but underneath it, since it's based upon these abstract principles, it's not that simple. So then he says he didn't understand that Yetzias Mitzrayim should be mentioned at night. Okay, because there's an obligation apparently to mention the Exodus every day. Okay, so this already introduces us to this concept that on Pesach night there's an obligation of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's a one-time thing. And yet every day there's an obligation to mention the Exodus. So that's a daily thing, and here we're going to learn that it's twice a day. Thus you need to explain what's the difference between the two. Why is there a need for a Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim on this night if there's a daily, we're mentioning or remembering it every day? What's the difference between what we do every day and what we do on this night vis-a-vis the recounting of the Exodus? But anyways, let's go on to the particular point. He says, I didn't demerit to understand why we do it at night. So apparently he understood why we do it by day, but not by night. Achedosha Ben Zoma, until Ben Zoma expounded. He expounded with the verse, and Emrah, as it says, Laman Tiskor is Yom Tzeis Chamer Tzayim Kol Yimecha, in order that you shall remember the day that you left Egypt all the days of your life. So you see that remembrance of Yetzias Mitzrayim is a daily obligation, all the days of your life. Okay, so that now he knows that there's a daily obligation, but it says the day, by day, from whence do you derive that you have to do so at night? Okay, so now it's going to get into a bit of exegesis. You know, nuances in the psukim come to include laws or requirements. So it says, Kol Yimei Chayecha. Kol Yimei Chayecha. I'm sorry, I skipped something. See, this is how he expounds it in brief. So it says, Yimei Chayecha. That's one of the methods that's used. That all it had to say was, Laman Tiskos Yom Tzeischa Meret Yisrayim, Yimei Chayecha. Okay, so Yimei Chayecha, if it just said that, the days of your life, so then I would say the days. Now, Kol, all, what do you mean all the days? Seemingly that word is superfluous, because why wouldn't I say all the days? What do I need to be told all the days? So, Kol Yimei Chayecha Halelos. So now he explained to him that all the days of your life refers to the night. Because it's like a ribui. That's, you know, if you study Gemara, this is a classical type of a methodology. All right, so now he understands. He learned something new. And that's a point. That's a point. That's a very great teaching in and of itself. That is, a person should be humble, because usually, I mean, this is kind of unusual. People at the age of 70 are not learning new things in general. I mean, even in the Torah world, and even among great scholars, because that's a reality that the people are not always entering everything with an open mind. They are. Perhaps when they're young and they're studying it for the first time. But, and you'll find this in the secular world, that someone is, you know, when he's young, he's challenging. There's a emotional motivation as well. I mean, he wants to make a name for himself. He's challenging, he's questioning, and so on and so forth. And then he reaches the point where he puts forth his own ideas, and reaches a point where it sort of becomes closed. it's very hard to challenge a person on something which he's already taken a position on. And especially if he's taken a position on it and written books on it, and so on and so forth. So that's as far as that person is concerned, it sort of becomes closed. You can't open it up. And you'll see. Now you'll see it on every level in human relationships. That friends, relatives, spouses, whatever it is, at a certain point you realize you can't talk to him about this. Closed mind. That's it. That's his position. Now, even if you have new information or evidence or whatever, it's not going to be greeted with an open mind. Because that's it. He's already made up his mind. Now, ideally, a person should have... Now, practically speaking, look, a person has to function that way. Whatever field he's in, he has to reach certain conclusions and operate by them, even if they're not perfect. But at least the individual has an open mind. If somebody comes to a doctor and he's been doing a certain procedure a certain way and tells him that he's discovered how you can improve it, or so on and so forth, the person should have an open mind. And not say, well, no, that's the way I've been doing it for the last 50 years. But you will see that's a very, very powerful tendency. And especially in older people. I don't find that older people, well, the truth is I don't find it that much with younger people. I think it's the rare person, a very rare person that really has an open mind and is willing to forget about what he said in the past. And let's hear what you have to say now. So that's what Ben Zoma is teaching. So that's what he's saying. So the subject matter actually is the subject matter of Kriya Shma. And now the Chachamim Omrim, the Chachamim, this is the Machlokas. So that's another thing that this paragraph introduces, the concept of Machlokas in Halacha, in Judaism. They say Yemei Chayecha HaOlam Hazeh, that Yemei Chayecha is a reference to the present situation, the present world. Kol Yemei Chayecha Lahavi Limos HaMashiach, but all the days of your life are to include it in the era of the Mashiach. So this already becomes a very juicy kind of a Machlokas. Very juicy kind of a machlokas. That is that he saw a need for the pasuk to provide a separate reference for the Messianic era. Of course, that itself, well, why should things change? That is, without this reference, apparently, according to the Chacham, then the mitzvah would expire. That the mitzvah is only relevant until the Messianic era. Now, once the Messianic era comes, there'd be good reason to believe that you no longer have the mitzvah of Kriya Shma. Of course, the question is why. But given if that's the reality, then you do need, and then the answer is, you have the pasuk. That's the pasuk came for. So now, practically speaking, then the Chachamim would maintain that it's not said by night. In other words, they all agree that you say Kriya Shma every day. The question is, do you say it at night? And that hinges upon the teaching of Kol, the word Kol, all the days. So now, if the word Kol is not utilized for the Messianic era, so then it's for the night. On the other hand, if it's utilized for the Messianic era, so then it's not for the night. So you'll have, you'll have the Chacham, that they say you only say it by day, but you don't say it by night, but you do say it in the Messianic era. So apparently, according to Ben Zoma, from whence does Ben Zoma learn that Kriya Shma is to be said in the Messianic era, because he doesn't have anything left over for that. He's used Kol Yimei Chayecha for the day and for the night. So what about in Yemos HaMashiach? So there's no teaching. So one could deduce from this that he would hold that you don't say it in the Messianic era.